walls, nor mosques, nor factories. They destroyed. Did you hear about this? You know, when the Taliban destroyed the Bamiyan Buddhas, it was a story that everyone in the world heard. But when a few days ago, Israel destroyed the Great Mosque of Gaza, a building that has existed for 1,500 years, and that includes elements of a synagogue and an early church and a mosque dating back to the 1300s. It was destroyed. This was a building I visited, and it was a place of serenity. And when I was there, it gave me hope, because I said, Gaza is full of beauty. It's full of ancient things. This siege will end. This horror will end, and Gaza will become a place for its people and for people of the world to visit and to see. I did not know about the beauty and the heritage and the history that was in Gaza until I went and I saw the pride of the people in it. To be given a tour of that mosque by the people who lived in that community and who loved it was a very moving experience. And one of the things I came out of Gaza thinking, this is a place that has a future. Well, the Omari Mosque, the Great Mosque of Gaza, is no more. It was completely destroyed. Completely destroyed. So not only are we talking about the killing of 1 in 1,000 people, but we're talking about the destruction of their history and the destruction of their heritage.
You have been listening to a talk by Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of The Struggle for Justice in Palestine. It was recorded at the Evanston Public Library, and the talk was recorded on August 11th during Israel's bombing of Gaza. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 11:01. We're about a half hour away from Black Book Talk, but first it's Between the Covers. Today, host David Naiman interviews David Mitchell, and that is coming up next.
2 years ago, Portland lost a musical and cultural icon with the passing of Ghanaian master drummer, bandleader, and teacher Obo Adi. His contribution to the raising of local knowledge and appreciation of African music in general, and Ghanaian music in particular, and his tireless work with local youth cannot be overstated. As part of our fall membership drive, KBOO is proud to present a celebration and retrospective of Obo's work on Thursday, October 2nd, from 1 until 4 p.m. Musical offerings, remembrances, and interviews will be part of this important figure's legacy. Join Andy Hosh and DJ Charlie and others at 1 p.m. on Thursday, October 2nd. The preceding hour, from noon until 1 p.m., will be filled with Ghanaian music as part of DJ Charlie's regular World Beat Connection time slot. See you then.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, David Mitchell, is best known for his intricately plotted novels, ones that adventure across the globe from Ireland and Mongolia to New York and Iraq, but also novels that span multiple time frames, from an 18th century Dutch trading post in Nagasaki Harbor to a futuristic dystopian Korea. From the get-go, David Mitchell's 1999 debut novel, Ghostwritten, received the John Llewellyn Rees Prize for the best work of British literature by an author under 35, a book that A.S. Byatt declared as one of the best debut novels she had ever read. In 2003, Mitchell was selected as one of Granta's best young British novelists, and in 2007, after the critical acclaim for his novels Cloud Atlas and Black Swan Green, Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. David Mitchell is here today on Between the Covers to talk about his latest novel, Bone Clocks, a book that not only travels the globe and travels through time, but also takes time itself as its central subject matter. Welcome to Between the Covers, David Mitchell.
Thank you very much, David. It's great to be here, and thanks also for that enthusiastically researched introduction.
Well, let's start with time. What about time compelled you to make a book that not only spans a great amount of time, but also contemplates it?
Time. Wow. This is straight in at the deep end, isn't it? How could you not be interested in time? It's like being a fish and not being interested in the sea. I mean, it's where we live. It's famous, I think an American astrophysicist, Wheeler, said this. It's what stops everything happening all at once. It's fascinating stuff. We live in it. We live through it. It ages us and changes us and turns us from tiny, tiny, tiny little one-celled being to birth, seven stages of man, into the care home if we're lucky, old age being a privilege that is denied to many. Isn't it interesting? Aren't you interested in time?
I am very interested in time. We were born in the same year, and you've mentioned that.
Right. Oh, you look younger than me. That's because you haven't been on a five-week book tour. That's why.
That's true. But you've mentioned bone clocks as being, in a way, a midlife crisis or a taking of account at midlife. Is that true?
Yeah, there's something in that. Maybe not so much time in a metaphysical sense, but mortality in a visceral, physical sense is maybe what the book's heart is.
And one of the questions that you propose is, what sort of Faustian bargain would you be willing to accept to potentially not have to confront mortality?
Sure. In a sense, to make yourself immune from the aging side effects of time. Yes, I do. Would you be willing to have your conscience amputated if this deal meant that other people had to suffer for it? Mm. Would you'd be willing to make the deal if every 10, 15 years you were willing to fake your own, you had to fake your own death to and move on and start somewhere else before people began to notice you weren't getting any older?
And for those who haven't read Bone Clocks, what is a bone clock exactly?
It's us. You and I are bone clocks. There's a cult, a kind of a cult in the novel who have, or do engage in this kind of a Faustian pact with a Gnostic occult machine set up many centuries ago, and you can't tell from their faces how many years they've lived and how many years they have yet to live. Whereas with our faces, you can guess our ages because our faces tell the time of our lives. So they disparagingly call us bone clocks because they are not bone clocks.
Well, one of the really interesting things about bone clocks and about a specific bone clock is the book seems at first glance really like an epic. I wrote down a list of and I'm sure I didn't get them all, but we're in Cambridge, we're in Switzerland, we're in Manhattan, we're in Vancouver, we're in Russia, Australia, Colombia, Shanghai, Iraq, and Iceland.
Wow, I clocked up the air miles, didn't I?
Yeah, and we spend time in the England of Margaret Thatcher, the Iraq of now, and the Ireland of the future when we run out of oil. But if you look closer at the skeleton of the book or the spine of the book, it really spans the course of one specific person's life, which almost feels hidden within all of this movement. Mm. Tell us about this person and essentially this person's bone clock that we're following in the course of the book.
I like your metaphor because skeletons are hidden, and Holly Sykes, the protagonist of the first and sixth parts and the narrator of those parts, is kind of the skeleton of the book. She sometimes goes off camera, but pretty soon the camera finds her again. In the first section, we meet her as a teenage punkette runaway. In the second section, she's away for a while, but the protagonist kind of stumbles across her and is attracted to her in a Swiss ski resort in the early 90s. In the third section, we meet her kind of pretty much immediately because she's the partner of the narrator of that section. The narrator's a war reporter back from the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq in 2004, back for a family wedding on the south coast of England at Brighton. And Holly is the mother of his child, his daughter, his six-year-old. In the fourth section, she is a very improbable best-selling writer and a colleague, well, a first arrival of the narrator of that section. He's a past his best British novelist of fading powers who is pining for the glory days when he was the wild child of British letters and straddled the bestseller lists on both sides of the Atlantic. And he meets Holly and feels contempt for her at first, but at festivals, and it's kind of this world. It's a novella set in the book tour, monstrously vain novelist's world. The fifth part, that's almost, I mean, if I start talking about that, we'll take up the whole 45 minutes of the programme, I fear, but that's a more fantastical part where the laws of physics and nature get bent and then broken and then exploded. And she's, Holly is wrapped up in that. She's in her late 40s, early 50s by then, I think. And then we meet her in the final part as a grandmother and as a guardian of a ward. And of course, she has a 70-year-old woman's body by then in the west of Ireland.
You have a particular knack and talent for writing a certain type of man in your books, I believe. And
Thank you.
I was trying to figure out what this type of man was.
Okay.
But I would call him ethically impaired and often comically and horribly self-consumed. And but yet, despite this, just addictively delightful to spend time with.
Thank you.
And you've done that in multiple novels where you just want to spend time with these somewhat horrible male characters. And I was curious what it was like. It feels like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like Bone Clocks has the most sustained female protagonist for you in your work.
It does. It certainly does, yeah.
And I was interested in how that was. Was that an easy transition, or was that a challenge and a difficulty for you?
It was a challenge. It's quite a tall order to write across the gender divide in a sustained way, in a psychologically probing way. Probably even harder for men to write women than for women to write men, I think, because we live in a sexist society and they need to work out how we think to protect themselves in a way that men do not necessarily, in fact, quite rarely reciprocate. So yes, it was a challenge, but that's why it's attractive. That was a part of the constraint. And I knew there'd be a lot of men in it anyway, so a lot of female energy in a sort of yin-yang balancing kind of way seemed an intelligent way to go about the novel.
Now we're going to be joined by the folks at Membership, who can tell you how you can get a copy of David Mitchell's latest novel, Bone Clocks, and become a member of KBOO in the process.
Thank you, David. My name is Sam. I'm here with Will, and
Hello.
This is KBOO's fall membership and fundraising drive. The phone number to call to become a member, renew your membership, or just drop some dough is 877-500-5266. How about $5 a month? That will get you your very own copy, or more if you want, but that $5 a month or more will get you your very own copy of The Bone Clocks by today's guest, David Mitchell. And so, as I said, my name is Sam.
And my name is Will.
Yes.
And it is my pleasure to be here too, working with Sam to try and raise some money for this fantastic organization. And I can tell you, in my volunteering at KBOO, that was how I found out about the book Cloud Atlas, and I got it on audio and really enjoyed it. A terrific book. And I want to check out this one, this Bone Clock, I believe it's called.
Bone Clocks, plural, more than one.
Yeah.
How about that for value?
Indeedy. And this is a great in-depth interview between David Mitchell and David Naiman, and I'm enjoying it a lot.
Whoa.
We're learning about both people, and David Mitchell certainly sounds like a very charming man. I'm looking forward to his new book.
Now, this isn't the Mitchell, the guy from Mitchell and Webb. This is a different David Mitchell.
It's not that David Mitchell. And it's not also the guy that kidnapped that Susan Smart. But anyway, what we can offer is this book available just by calling us at 877. 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266.
You know, Mr. Mitchell's publisher has been very kind to provide KBOO with several copies of this book so that KBOO can take that money that you might have spent on this book and instead decided to put a little more on top and invest that in KBOO, and that we could reward that that impulse there that you had with your very own copy and another year of fierce, independent, and probing radio just for you and for all your friends and neighbors and pretty much everyone else with an internet connection who tunes into the web stream at kboo.fm, where you can also click on a little cartoon jar that says donate today, and it takes you through a quick, convenient, easy, and secure web form. You can make your fully tax-deductible 501c3 type, quote, charitable donation, unquote. I put that in quotes because those are the IRS's words, not mine. I call it an investment in community, an investment in the sort of electronic media that serves your interests. Because you're interested in the work of David Mitchell, and you're interested in so many other things that only KBOO brings you. And that's why you listen, and that's why you are going to call 877-500-5266. Why do you listen, Will?
I learn so much from KBOO. That's the main reason I listen. I enjoy the music programs, and they're terrific. And
you learn something there, too.
I learn about different music, certainly. I've learned about different bands, but it's what I learn from the news programs that I enjoy the most. Like, I've learned about this new book by David Mitchell. I'm definitely going to try and find that. And then I learned about the terrible struggles of the Palestinian people, thanks to the last program.
Yeah.
And I don't learn this information anywhere else. I really do value the resource that KBOO is, which is why I donate my time. But if you don't have time to donate, then you can donate some money, and you will be part of the community, and you'll be a member of KBOO by dialing 877-500-5266.
One reason I support KBOO, again, with my time, because like you, I have much more time than I have money.
Yep.
And we're hoping you'll supply some dollars, because I can't cover KBOO's PGE bill with my time.
I
can do other stuff. But so I'm doing my part. Now it's time for you, dear listener, to do your part. I was going to say my support for KBOO, one reason I support KBOO is that KBOO has volunteers who train other volunteers in how to make radio.
Yep.
All the different aspects, you know, production and editing and writing and all this stuff. And for the folks who maybe didn't manage to get into the University of Oregon's Masters of Journalism program and or didn't have $10,000 a year to spend on it, can learn it for free right here. And that's because you, dear listener, support KBOO. So call 877-500-5266. Make sure the next generation of book writers arts and entertainment and culture critics and news journalists have the training they need to bring you the information you need, because you gave KBOO the money it needs. 877-500-5266. Closing thoughts, Will.
And you can become one of those people just by coming down to 20 Southeast 8th. You can meet Arnie, our wonderful volunteer director, and she will tell you when the next volunteer orientation is. And then you can come in. It's a short training period, and then they will set you loose on producing shows, working on the local news. You could have the position I have, which is as a receptionist, which is a phenomenal thing to do because you get to meet so many interesting people. You get to be part of this amazing radio station. But if you don't have that time, you can still be part of this amazing radio station by calling us at 877-500-5266.
Let's hear a little bit more from one of my favorite Davids, Dr. David Naiman, and my new second favorite David, Mr. David Mitchell.
We're back with David Mitchell, the author of Bone Clocks. Ursula Le Guin, in her review of Bone Clocks, she compared some of your style in it to Virginia Woolf. And she said, while she does stream of consciousness, you do stream of self-consciousness. And she was looking at The Waves, which is told in past tense, Virginia Woolf's book, and also sort of marveling at Bone Clocks being a book about time, but a book that has no past in the sense that it's written in the perpetual now, in the present tense. Mm. Did you know you were going to write Bone Clocks in the present tense? And is that somehow related to the theme?
Yeah, if you write in the present tense, especially first person present tense, in a way it can't not be about time. Novels have certain default themes. Time is one, because novels take place over time. You can't have it happening all at once. It's a linear, sequential art form, unlike a painting, which is simultaneous. Novels are also sort of automatically about identity. I mean, you've got people in them. You're making a person in them. A novel can't really not be about identity. It can't not be about memory either, for the same reason. You can spot these default themes on book descriptions, on back jackets, when the author and the writer or the editor aren't quite sure how to describe the novel. So you time and time again get sort of an enchanting meditation on identity, memory, and time. Yeah. How often have you read that?
A million times.
Not knocking it. I think I probably used the same formula. But my last novel was also, that was third person present tense. I kind of like that constraint. You move forward at the speed of time. You're sort of like a surfer who never falls off the surfboard on the wave of now. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are costs to it. Narratorial omniscience, forget it. That's not going to happen, for one thing. You are chained to that surfboard, but it's sort of a surfboard I like. I think for the next one, I'd best stop it now. I've kind of done enough present tensing, and I'd sort of maybe go back to the past, maybe third person past. I might do something really traditional. That could be fun.
Well, you mentioned the loss of omniscience and retrospection in the constant present tense, but you sort of solve that a little bit with having the part of the story be people who are immortal. And you mentioned the cults. And on the one hand, the Bone Clock is about a single human life. On the other hand, it is an epic fantastical battle between immortal time travelers, right?
Time travelers by virtue of the fact that they don't really ever properly die. They're not time travelers in the sense that they have a TARDIS or a time machine.
Right, that's a good point. But what's interesting is that you've said before that this fantastical element has allowed you to show the reader the way that human beings would be seen from time's perspective.
Oh, did I say that? That sounds quite clever.
Does that seem familiar to you? Can you talk about how one of the points of view by providing these figures in the book is one to see ourselves from the perspective of time?
Yeah, sure. My horologists have meta-lives. So that's the chain of lives that they live. So the horologists are the more vegetarian immortals. Their immortality does not cost anybody anything. They simply die. They do age. They die. But however they die, 49 days later, they find themselves waking up in the body of a very sick child who has actually died, so the soul has vacated the building or the body, and the horologist's soul then enters that one. The horologists don't know why this happens. It's not an act of will. They can't get out of it. They're kind of stuck in a kind of Groundhog Day, in a sense. But they have meta-lives, and of course, you know... Marinus, who's a character both in my last novel, where he was having his 28th lifetime in 1799, 1800, and is now on his, or her, 34th lifetime, I think, in about 2024, I think we meet her. For them, the human lives, even if humans they love, it's kind of like cats that we own. You know, we own a sequence of cats who maybe live 7, 8, 9 years, maybe 13, 14, if we're lucky. Or if you live in West Cork, where I live, they appear to vanish after about 2 years and go and live in the house of the village mad cat lady because the food there is better. But our lives are that brief for them. So the horologists, in fact, there's one whose meta-life has already lasted millennia. And their viewpoint is time's viewpoint. And, of course, they're sentient beings, so unlike time, which is an abstract continuum, the horologists can actually talk about it.
Hmm. It feels like a sneaky way around the present tense conundrum.
I'm a sneaky writer, David. I'm a sneaky cat.
Once again, we're going to invite some people from membership to tell you how you can get a copy of David Mitchell's Bone Clocks and also become a member of KBOO.
Well, you start with calling 877-500-5266, or you can use the website kboo.fm. There's a little cartoon jar. It says donate today, you know, in the present tense. You know, you're rather stuck with the present tense conundrum, because now is the time that we need to hear from you, and you are the one we need to hear from. So There it is. Pick up your phone. 877-500-5266. Log on to the old internet there. Jump through the series of tubes that will land you at kboo.fm and make your contribution that way. However you do it, just do it right now.
We really implore you to do that, and we want to say thank you when you do, and we also want to thank everybody out there who's listening right now. But it is so very important to become a member of KBOO. It's a simple thing to do, it's an inexpensive thing to do, and it is a vital thing to do. I've actually listened to an interview with David Mitchell on another radio resource, and it was nowhere near as in-depth, it was nowhere near as incisive, and I think this show is terrific. It's certainly making me want to read the book, and David Naiman has obviously really enjoyed the book, and is talking to an extremely interesting author. I wish I'd read more. I've read Cloud Atlas, but you can get hold of this book, Bone Clocks, through KBOO. Now, you could get hold of it by going into a shop and buying it, but it's not the same thing. You're not showing the pledge that you feel that KBOO is a valuable part of your life and a valuable part of Portland. So please call us at 877-500-5266. We have many wonderful volunteers standing by the phones, eager to answer the phone and take your information, and thank you for becoming a supporting member of KBOO. So it's 877-500-5266.
You know, bringing you this program is going to cost KBOO in about $88.
But it's worth it.
Well, here's the thing.
Where's the thing?
It's right here, okay, and I'm about to tell the people.
You do it.
So you, dear listener, can help cover that with your support of $7.50 a month. You will cover today's broadcast of, what's it called?
Between the Covers?
Yeah, that one. You know, it's like, I'm so spellbound. You know, I just listen. I just turn on KBOO and just leave it on. And I don't always catch the name of the program. But
it's a cornucopia of audio.
Yes. It was that one that was on Thursday about 11 o'clock. It was David Naiman was... Yeah, it was David Naiman was interviewing the Bone Clocks guy.
David Mitchell.
Yes, this is such a great program. And it's time for you to support what you get, because you love it so much and you need to know that it's going to be there. So we need to know that you're there for KBOO. 877-500-5266. You know, so many convenient ways to do it. You can have us send you a bill and you mail us a check. You can use your credit or debit card to make one lump payment or stretch it out over the year. Or you can have it deducted painlessly and easily from your checking account. What's most important, though, is that you make that move. KBOO.FM or by phone at 877-500-5266. We're going back right now, so make that call.
We are back with David Mitchell, the author of Bone Clocks. We've been talking about a couple different ways you're a sneaky writer, David Mitchell. But the way that I think you're the sneakiest...
My wife could give you a few more, but go on.
Okay. So the way that I think you're sneakiest is that I think with all of your novels, and Bone Clocks included, the first thing you feel is that you're going on a fun adventure. You're engaged, you're immersed, and you're going on a delightful journey of some sort. However, with Bone Clocks, I feel like you're sneaking a whole lot of darker themes into this, even though we're getting this primary feeling of pleasure. And it was interesting, again, in the Ursula Le Guin review, she calls it a freewheeling inventiveness, your style, but also then says that that death is at the heart of the novel. And I was thinking if you list all of the things that are in Bone Clocks, there's a whole bunch of things that you touch on, the debacle that is Iraq that is ongoing, the post-oil climate change apocalyptic future, the potential death of publishing, class anxiety. And you find a way to package this and sneak it into the book and contemplate it while making us almost feel like it's not happening at the same time. So what are you doing there?
Well, firstly, thank you. I could weep with gratitude at the intelligence of your remark. Thank you. Yes, I do all of that because I want to, because these themes matter to me, and because I wanted to write an omnivorous novel with all these things in. It is replete with ideas. I am at heart a novelist. I'm not at heart an academic or a critic or a scholar or a great big thinker or even a small thinker. I'm a novelist, but novels need ideas, like bread needs yeast and a diet needs vitamin C, of course. What's going on? I'm I'm middle aged. My relationship with mortality needs a reboot. This young guy who I'm used to seeing in the mirror is no longer there, actually, and you need to handle that, and you need to think about it. It's serious stuff. Mortality is not an abstract over the horizon anymore. It's in your kneecaps. It's in your back. It's in your lungs.
Well, my favorite section was the last section. It was really amazing that the section that takes place in Ireland. It's post oil climate collapse. It's a near future. But what's really fascinating to me about it is we're in this freewheeling sense of expanding possibility, and then we land in this place of real limitation. And all the things that we take for granted or took for granted are no longer possible, or if they're possible, they're extremely difficult. I was wondering if that was a direction you're going with future work, if there was something very fascinating about that limitation of place and capacity of those characters after what they'd been through in the first five sections.
Yeah. Holly, well, she's an old woman. She can't walk, but it's a future without cars, pretty much. And so she doesn't leave within a mile and a half radius of the opening of that whole final novella, compared to all the most squanderous globe-trotting that goes on in earlier sections of the book. And those are the terms of the world. It's sort of more like the 17th century than the 21st, in a way. It's a constraint, and as we've said, constraint and originality are linked. And I worry that it might be accurate. I worry that the act of futurology may be something we're condemning our children to, certainly our grandchildren. If we don't invent nuclear fusion pretty darn quickly, I don't see how this world, this studio, our aviation, our agriculture, our manufacturing, the means by which we meet our plethora